Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 165. And Chris Allenack is here to give us a brief summary. We visited this issue a couple of times during the interim and have some experts down here to talk about it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What this bill does is that it modifies the eligibility for the income subject to the preferential tax rates for non-passive income. It adds the requirement that the number of full-time employees must increase from the prior year and that there should be no decrease in the employee average hourly wage. It would be effective in 2018. And then I do just want to point out there is some there's some background information here related to the policy as well. I can either go through or I'm just notifying you that it's there for your awareness.
Go ahead.
So just for some background, this was a policy that was established in the 2013 special session. The base approach here on the chart on the top, just at a very high level, the way income taxes work is that we have all the personal income minus deductions, mainly Schedule A deductions, multiplied by the regular rates is kind of our baseline system. For taxpayers who want to opt in to this preferential rate system, there's this alternate calculation where the non-passive income from the pass-through entities would be multiplied by the new rates, and that would result in what I've called a gross tax B1 here, and then all of the other income, wages, capital gains, other types of income, would go into this other pot, and then from that, Schedule A deductions would be subtracted, and then that net amount would be multiplied by regular tax rates, and that would result in what I've called gross tax B2. Those two gross tax amounts would be summed to the total gross tax B, and then the taxpayer would choose the lesser of either gross tax A or gross tax B. It's basically taking the pot of income subject to personal income taxes and putting it into two pots. So you have this non-passive income. So, for example, you can have a taxpayer, say a joint filer, and one spouse has wage income and the other spouse has non-passive income. The way the personal income tax system works right now, all of that income is combined, and then deductions are taken against that income, and then that taxable income is multiplied by the tax rates, and then we get to credits. What this policy does is for the non-passive income, it pulls that out, applies that to separate tax rates, and then all of the wage income and the other regular income is available to be reduced by Schedule A deductions. And that that taxable income is multiplied by the regular tax rates, and then those two amounts are added together. And so what we have here, the joint income tax rates, so the regular tax system has the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9%. And the non-passive income, depending on the amount, is subject to rates that range between 7 and up to the 9.9. So the key things here is that the non-passive income can be subject to a 7% tax rate all the way up to an amount of $250,000, but it can't be reduced by Schedule A deductions. So, and we have some preliminary information. There's been a lot of interest in this, so I've been working with the Department of Revenue to get a handle on what we're seeing with 2015 tax returns. 2015 was the first year that this policy was in place, and the estimated revenue impact back in 2013 that I made was about $90 million, that it would cost $90 million for 2015. What we saw in the tax returns was a cost of about $66 million, so we're at about 75% of that cost. And there's been some testimony, and you may hear some today, about provisions that some taxpayers were unaware of this, so they weren't able to take advantage of it. So right now, that's the preliminary revenue impact we have. We're also looking at tax return information to try and get a handle at who's claiming it and what these taxpayers look like in anticipation of policies like what you have in Senate Bill 165. And so if we scroll down a little bit, there's a table here for the number of entities per tax return. So here we're looking at on the Schedule E, which is where this income is reported, taxpayers can have multiple business or multiple businesses, and what we have here is a sample of 500 returns where about 87% of them showed one entity on the tax return. Another 10% showed a taxpayer having income from two entities, and then all the way up to just a handful of tax returns. So 1% in this sample actually had this kind of income from five entities. And then another way to slice the data is we looked at about 6,000 companies and tried to get a handle on what size the companies are. And so here we have a distribution by the number of employees within the company. So about 2% of them we weren't able to link up very well, but the largest category there is the 11 to 25 group, where we have 29% of the returns fall into that size company. And then between the 3 to 5 and the 26 to 50, so most of these entities fall within the size of 3 employees to 50 employees. Now, this is all sample information, so it is draft and it's subject to revision as we move forward and refine how we're able to look at the information. But given the interest level here, I wanted to share this at this point just so we have some sense moving forward, because this all sets the foundation for understanding the potential revenue impact of any policy changes. And then the last thing here is a sectoral breakdown. And so here we have about 500 companies again. So without getting into all the minutiae, we had limitations on how we could look at the information. So here we have 500 companies. About 12% of them are construction companies. The plurality are the professional, scientific, and technical services companies. They were about 20%. And then the rounding out the top three, we have the healthcare and social assistance companies, another 12%. And then for 50 companies, we weren't able to identify the sector. So this is just kind of background information on informing the policy decision that was made and what we're seeing on the returns and what information DOR is able to link together between the actual tax return and employment data so we can provide the legislature as much information as possible about the impact of the policy.
And then 165 changes. How it changes this?
It changes the policy by adding an additional requirement that the number of employees on a year-over-year basis has to increase, the number of FTE, full-time equivalent, has to increase, and there cannot be a decrease in the average hourly wage of the employees. So right now there just has to be one employee, one non-owner employee, and a certain number of hours requirement. So this policy in 165 would add some sort of growth requirement in terms of the FTE.
And it has to be an increase, not 5 or 10, just it could be 1.
Correct. It just says it has to increase, and it's not the number of employees, it's the number of full-time equivalents.
Okay. Senator Boquist, did you have
a technical question? Chris, professional, scientific, and technical, is that where the lawyers are at?
I would think so. Tend to think of those as consulting firms, but I believe that's where they would lie.
Your LLPs have fallen there.
Right. Okay. I believe so.
And how many, there's 530, could you just scroll back and how many total filings were there?
The number of income tax returns I actually didn't include here. It's about 13,000 claimants.
Okay. All right.
So if we scroll back up to the number of entities per return, or scroll down a little bit. There we go.
All right.
So it depends if we're talking about the individual income tax returns or the businesses. For example, you can have a partnership with five partners. So that's one business, but it'll be five, up to five individual tax returns.
Mm-hmm.
So it can get a little confusing because the perspective changes. And to get this information, we had to go for sample information, for example, on the number of returns, it's only 500. That was a sample. We had a sample of 500 returns to try and match that.
And there's no real way to quantify in this information new jobs, if any, were created?
The only potential way to do that would be to look at these companies. We're able to see the number of employees here and then compare them year over year, possibly, there might be a way to determine that if a company went from 50 employees to 51 employees. Mm-hmm. That involves linking with the employment department data. So the potential is there, but once we start going down that path, we start losing actual return. So it becomes a sample-based exercise.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Hey, if you recall, Mr. Chairman, we're hopeful with all of our investments in IT and our ability to coordinate with the federal government, because on the federal tax side, there are numbers like that are available. We just haven't got to the point where we can reach out and get those data. I mean, so it's not just employment department. I do have one technical question, though, for Chris, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The bill draft itself on page 2 outlines the employment piece, and if I look correctly, it's the Department of Revenue who will figure that out some way. Is that not correct? Or put it on the form or something. It's the Department of Revenue's responsibility, right? Versus Business Oregon, in which is why there wasn't an employment one on, because nobody believed Business Oregon could do this because they have never successfully done it in the past.
It doesn't specifically say, but DOR administers this.
Okay.
So that's what it looks like. I don't know if DOR has a different read on it, but without specifically identifying somebody, I think it would probably fall on that.
Yeah. Mr. Yeah. Chair.
Senator Riley.
So, Chris, we talked about it has to be a greater number of FTEs from the previous year, but it doesn't even have to be a full FTE the way I read this. It could be someone going from halftime to three-quarter time.
I believe that's correct. It's just a net in this. Precise words are compared to the immediately preceding tax year. The partnership or S corporation has a net increase in full-time equivalent employees, and then it gets to the
could
the
be a quarter piece. Of a FTE increase.
Correct. It just has to be a net increase.
Yeah. Okay, Dick Solomon has been watching this in the private sector. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. For the record, my name is Richard B. Solomon. I'm a certified public accountant who has practiced in Portland for over 40 years. My work is limited to tax planning and preparation of tax returns, primarily for high net worth individuals and professionals like doctors and lawyers. I'm here at the request of Chair Haas and represent only myself. By way of background, you may recall that on September 21st, 2016, I testified before the committee regarding the PTE reduced tax rate. At that time, I testified that I opposed the reduced tax rate for pass-through entities because I felt it was a waste of the state's resources and it was unfair because it favored some business entities, such as S-corps, partnerships, and multi-member LLCs, over other forms, including sole proprietors, single-member LLCs, and C-corporations. I continue to oppose the concept of reduced tax rates for owners of pass-through entities, but I'm here today to support Senate Bill 165. The original intent of HB 3601, which created the reduced PTE tax rate, was to encourage job growth, but the costly program does not currently require employers who benefit from the reduced rate to actually increase employment. SB 165 corrects that by requiring businesses benefiting from the reduced income tax rate to increase their number of full-time equivalent employees, as well as increase the employee's average hourly wage. Consequently, as a result of SB 165, the tax benefit would at least be somewhat aligned with the objective of the increased employment. But even with the reforms of SB 165, it seems like the PTE preferential tax rate is a roundabout and inefficient means to promote employment. A better way to spend tax dollars might be to provide employers a tax credit against any increase in state unemployment tax. Such a credit would be a direct offset to employers' additional costs, and a credit would not discriminate based on the employer's form of business, which currently advantages S-corps and multi-member LLCs over C-corps and sole proprietors. But there are downsides to SB 165. The proposed change is cumbersome and may add significant complexity to the preparation of the tax returns. For many employers, it's no easy task to determine if there's a net increase in FTEs and average hourly wage. Additionally, the state-provided tax benefit to employers may greatly exceed the employer's added payroll costs. Let's take an example. A professional partnership of 50 lawyers would be able to get an Oregon tax break if they increase their staff's pay by only 1% and added only one clerk. The reduction in the company's income tax might dwarf any costs they incur. The bill also does not address how the provision would be interpreted. For example, suppose a 10-partner medical practice divided into two five-partner firms. Would they be treated as two new firms with zero prior year payroll, so both firms would be eligible for the tax break, even though there was no net increase in staff? Before finishing, I also want you to know that I strongly support SB 164, which would extend the PTE tax benefit to taxpayers filing amended return. That bill, which is not being considered today, is a needed reform because it eliminates a trap for many taxpayers who prepare their own returns and weren't aware of the provision, or who didn't have accountants who are aware of the provision. So in summary, I continue to oppose HB 3601, which established the preferential rate, but I do support SB 165. Thanks for the opportunity to address you today. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Dick. You had some clients that you helped through this process. Can you give us an idea of their situation and how it worked?
I would say that all the clients that I had that took advantage of this, not one was aware of it. So to the question, did they add employment? They may have added employment in their businesses, but they weren't aware of it. Some are aware of it now, but I think they make decisions based on economic factors, not this tax break. And some of my clients got not insignificant benefit. I think one got an $18,000 tax benefit from doing this, and you know, he of course thinks I'm a genius for finding this, but doing this. But he had no knowledge of this before, and I think that was true of all the clients. Now, my clients tend to be doctors and lawyers, and they're focused on other issues. But they got this, as I'd say, a kind of gift from heaven. One thing that Senator Boquist asked and is the department going to compute this, or is the taxpayer? And I would say that the taxpayer is going to have to do this. I mean, our responsibility as tax preparers is to prepare a complete and accurate return, and we couldn't take this. Let's say you had a client who has income from a pass-through entity. You couldn't take this reduced tax rate to elect this without really knowing. I mean, it's our responsibility. We can't. The State Department or the Department of Revenue, unless they audit, they won't know. So it would be there. It's the taxpayer's responsibility to do this calculation. And as I say, it may not be an easy computation to make.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was anybody's intention to help doctors and lawyers pay less in Oregon taxes. So, and I thank you for engaging in this. I guess the real sort of policy question for us is whether to just junk this idea altogether and find a more effective way to help small businesses and add jobs and create capital. And it sounded like at the beginning of your testimony, you suggested unemployment insurance or, you know,
That would be at least a more direct benefit related to what the employer do. If you want to encourage employers to add employees, every employer pays state unemployment tax, you know, on the first 38,000 of wages. So you could make a direct benefit to that cost. This is kind of roundabout, and they wouldn't, you know, as I say, they may not know about it, and it only affects if you're in a single member LLC, you don't get this benefit. If you're in a two member LLC or multi member, you would. If you're in a S corp, you get the benefit. If you're in a C corp, you don't. So I guess what I'm suggesting is don't discriminate just on the form of doing business. People pick the form for all kinds of tax reasons. You might be an S corp or a C corp, but you shouldn't be disadvantaged in this benefit by reason of how you organize your business.
Yeah. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate you coming down here, Dick.
We do have a list of some people who would like to weigh in on this. I'm going to call them up. T.J. Riley, Anthony Smith, and Matt Evans.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith. I'm the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents about 7,000 small businesses in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. And although 90% of our Oregon members have fewer than 25 employees and 70% have fewer than 10 employees, the small businesses we represent account for over 60,000 Oregon jobs, just to give you a little reference of who we are and who we represent. LRO did a great job kind of bringing us up to speed on that just now, and back in December, there was also a very good presentation, and actually have that slide. There was a slide that wasn't included on that presentation that was in the presentation from back in December, and that was the distribution of the tax savings that the people, the actual 13,000 filers who took advantage of this in 2015, how that distribution played out. And I've got the numbers there right in front of me, but about 74% of these filers had their 2015 tax burden reduced by $5,000 or less. And it was 86.7%, it was reduced by $10,000 or less. So our take on that is that for the vast majority of filers, the tax savings alone didn't offset the cost of a new employee's salary, but would certainly be a part of the equation for small businesses looking to hire, reinvest, or grow their business, which is really, there are many measures of how a small business is growing from year to year. Some years you might make a capital investment. Some years you might be able to hire a few more people. As you're growing your business, it's not always a net gain in FTEs that is the measure of whether you're moving in the right direction where you want to be heading. So there was also talk last fall of about who was benefiting from the tax structure. And so, you know, we have a pretty decent sized membership. And so we decided to survey our members, as we often do, to kind of figure out, you know, who's taking advantage of this tax rate, you know, what industries are they from. And so I'd like to share some of those numbers with you. 65% of our survey respondents were structured as a partnership, S Corp or LLC. 28% of the respondents reported using the small business pass-through rates in 2015. 20% of the respondents were aware of the rate structure before filing their taxes. Just 20% were aware of the special rate before filing their taxes. And 42% of respondents said that they were planning to use the rate structure in 2016. So our takeaway from that is that small businesses were largely unaware of the change in tax policy, but upon learning more about the tax structure, which types of business entities qualify and which types of income qualify, small businesses were much more likely to integrate the use of the small business pass-through tax rates into their business plans going forward. And many, many respondents reported that they were going to be following up with their CPAs this year. and one respondent particularly summed it up very well, and I'll quote him here. He said the small business pass-through rates, quote, help the small business owner to reinvest into the company, to upgrade, replace, or purchase new equipment, or to hire more employees and better serve our customers and our community. Summing things up, I just reiterate that linking the small business pass-through tax rates to net job gains could actually disadvantage small businesses and startups that actually need the capital the most. And if we're going to make any changes at the policy, at our view, we would recommend expanding the rate structure to all small businesses, which would undoubtedly increase opportunities for the types of job gains that I think you guys are looking for. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Let's go through all three of you, and then we'll ask questions.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans with Wagon Tire Consulting, and I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. It's been a tough week in this committee for small businesses. Just our discussion the other day of Senate Joint Resolution 3, which would dramatically increase property taxes on all Oregonians, including, of course, small businesses that own their own property or have to pay rent. It's in part based on property taxes. We just encourage committee members to remember that the bulk of the general fund is generated by business activity, and efforts to lower business activity in the state means that there's less money here in the capital for you all to do the jobs that you believe are important to do for Oregonians. Encouraging small business in Oregon to add jobs and to pay good wages is certainly worthy goals. But SB 165 is not a bill that will accomplish those goals. Small businesses grow when they have an increasing market for their good or service. Barring that growth, additional employees merely reduce the amount of money that's available to the business to try to create additional growth in their business. Very few small businesses are in a position to add a new job every year to keep the current low tax rate that they might enjoy. It was interesting to see some of the charts up here. You imagine a small business with 10 employees. You're talking about asking that business to increase their employment by 10%. And I thought Senator Riley's question before was germane. When I think of an FTE, I think of 1.0. I don't think of 1.25 as an increase in full-time equivalent employment. An increase in full-time equivalent employment is 2.0 from 1.0. I think that's something that definitely needs to be clarified somehow in this bill. It's really not likely that a very small business, a 10-employee or 5-employee business, is going to be able to add an employee every single year in order to keep a tax break that doesn't come close to paying for that, even a small part of that employee's wage benefit, the other costs, tax costs, and so forth of adding an employee. And probably worse yet, even those small businesses who are currently growing face an uncertain future. SB 165 makes the uncertainty worse. And you all know what businesses want is stability and certainty, whatever the policies are. I'm sure I don't need to remind the committee members about the recently concluded Great Recession. Facing even a more moderate economic downturn than that severe one in the future, small businesses wouldn't be looking to add employees to keep a tax break. They'd be probably shedding employees as they did during the last recession, or they'd be looking to reduce wages, not keep them level or try to increase them. They'd get hit, in this case, with a double whammy, a recession that lowers their business ability and gives them also a higher tax rate on the money they are able to earn as a going concern. With Oregon amongst the most dependent states in the nation on small businesses for our jobs, SB 165, frankly, is a prescription for deepening and lengthening the carnage during the next economic downturn that the state will suffer at some point in the future. I also thought the previous witness did a good job of talking about complexity. I understand why somebody who prepares tax returns for a living would love this bill. I'm sure my tax guy will. If you're billing by the hour, you want SB 165 to pass, because the time it took to explain how it's all going to fit together and what kind of business gets what break and how you've got to figure out what kind of income it was and from who, that's not the direction to go. If you want to help businesses, look at the tax system's complexity and try to reduce it. Look at the regulatory regime in this state. If you want people to hire more employees, cut back on the amount of money they have to spend complying with regulations and complying with the tax system. To no one's surprise, the Taxpayer Association urges a no vote on SB 165. Thank you for your time. We'd be happy to stay around and answer any questions you might have.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is T.J. Riley. I'm the current president of the Oregon Small Business Association. We represent and communicate with approximately 6,000 small business owners across Oregon. One of the fallacies with small business is everybody thinks that every business is profitable and profitable every year. And that's just quite not the case. The current stats are about half of every new business is going to fail within 5 years. And after 10 years, only 30% of them are going to be left. Now, while some of these businesses will make a profit in 1 year because of many different factors, often the following year they don't make a profit. And so the Oregon Small Business Association sees this SB 165 is nothing more than a tax increase, and we just want to go on record as opposing. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, clearly there's something that needs to be fixed in this bill so that we don't have a situation where, after the fact, a wealthy doctor calls his CPA and says, hey, congratulations, thanks for doing this. So, again, our question is this measure fixable, or is there a better way to honor this intent that we had 3 years ago to help small businesses create more capital and jobs? And I'm an old-time legislator, Tony Van Vliet, who's in the Legislative Hall of Fame, once told me some advice when I first started is don't fix bad laws. Change, start over and change. So I kind of have that in the back of my head here is maybe this is so complex, and trying to fix it makes it even more complicated. And I was just wondering if, you know, along the lines of Dick Solomon's suggestion, you know, look at something else, look at the unemployment insurance. Maybe there's something there, that maybe there's something that's more effective than this or a fix on this.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'll take a whack at that one. I think there's some value in even-handedness with regard to application of tax policy, I'm not sure I agree with that. We need to figure out a way to punish wealthy doctors. I've had two doctors that treat my 95-year-old mother quit their practices in the last 6 months based on what's going on nationally and has been going on for the last several years with the health insurance situation. Something that applies over all businesses equally is difficult to find because businesses are varied. They're as diverse as you can imagine, from one person toiling in their garage office to very large companies in this state. We don't have a lot of them, but we do have them that have 10,000 employees. Trying to find a policy that's a one-size-fits-all and provides an equal benefit to all of those entities is an extremely difficult and complicated task. So I'm not sure there is a way to do it, something that's general like an unemployment tax, although, you know, obviously I'm not anxious to see you give unemployment tax breaks to companies that frequently lay off employees. Something that's more generic to look at probably is a good way to, for this committee to go. You don't have, as I mentioned earlier, you don't really have responsibility for regulatory regimes. But on the finance side, something that's more broad-based would probably be a wise area to delve into.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Roiley?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. excuse me. I don't think that our goal is to give a wide tax break to all companies. I think the goal is to help those companies who need help to grow. And I think that we need to keep that in mind when we're looking at this. Just giving out money to everybody is not a good idea, but to help those companies that actually need a little help to grow or to keep going is a good idea.
Thank you. Good point. All right. Thank you. Appreciate
your engagement on this. A couple more. Jason Orm, OSCPA.
Can I ask a question of Chris?
Yes. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. So can they, because this is new, would employers be able to go back and file for 1, 2, 3 years and it only starts going forward, or can they go back?
One of the provisions of this, the short answer is no.
Okay.
I can leave it there, or I can go into.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to know if folks would be able to go back. And then I guess I have a two-part question. The other part is, if the income of the company goes up a certain percentage, is this no longer allowed? I mean, meaning that if all of a sudden they made 20% more that year, is this still allowed? There's no adjustment based on an increase in profits, or?
Correct. It would still be allowed. It's not tied to any other. There's no limitation for profit growth or income growth.
So a company could be making a lot more money and they may not add employees.
Correct. Under current law, they have to have one employee. There is no requirement for a change in the number of employees.
Okay, three parts to your ask. So someone could make 20% more, had the ability to hire 2 or 3 more people, but maybe didn't need to hire 2 or 3 more people.
And then they could still benefit from this.
Okay, yeah. Just wanted to.
Under current
law.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Orm. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Orm. I am a member of and past chair of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a practicing CPA with a large local firm, Talbot, Corvola, and Warwick in Lake Oswego, and this is my 29th tax season. Thank you. On behalf of the 4,500 plus members of the OSCPA, I'm here to testify with respect to Senate Bill 165, and I urge you to reject this bill. I've heard you already this morning talk about the complexity. I've heard the discussion. This adds ambiguity and complexity to an already complex provision. For example, what's the definition of FTE? You've had the discussion of, is that defined in the bill? It is not. Who makes that determination? Maybe it's ODR. What is full-time? Is that 2,080 hours? Is it something else? Does that full-time include vacation pay, sick pay, paid holidays? Does it not? What about salaried employees? Salaried employees, we don't track in many industries hours because you're not required to. They're paid a salary. So how is a salaried employee treated? Are organizations, companies now going to be required to track hours for salaried employees? What about those who work overtime? Can an individual who works 2,500 hours of overtime, approximately 20%, is that individual 1.2 FTEs? Or is that individual 1 FTE? What is the definition of net increase? I've heard that discussed already this morning. If I have a net increase in FTEs of 0.001, is that an increase? Mathematically it is, but is that the intent? Think about the record keeping of employers of all sizes who have salaried employees who are now going to be tracking hours on salaried employees. In determining what your average wage is, what's the denominator? What do we divide by? Is it 2080? Is it some other number? None of this is described in the bill. These are just a few of the ambiguities and complexities. I went through tax season last year, and I will tell you that this was new to a number of people. As we started, I called five of my friends that are in smaller practices and said, do you know about this? A couple of them said, yes. A couple of them said, know about what? These are not bad practitioners. These are great practitioners who are attempting to keep up with the amazing complexity and compliance that we do. In some industries, there's a shortage of skilled workers. We've heard about that in manufacturing. It was welders. Example, all of you have vehicles, I assume. All of you take them to a repair shop unless you're good enough to repair them on your own. There is a shortage of skilled technicians to repair our cars nationwide. I do work for a man who owns four repair shops. He can't find skilled employees. So what he has to do then is hire and grow them. So under this provision of Senate Bill 165, he hires two new people to replace the one that walked out the door a month ago. True story. He's going to spend the time and investment in growing these two people. Fabulous. Except under the provisions of this rule, he meets the one part of the test that he has an increase in FTEs, but he's not going to meet the part of the test that's hourly based, because he's going to pay these new people a lower rate because they're not worth the same amount as an experienced technician. So in the years when he's growing these people, he can't take this benefit. And this is a small business. Now the people are online, they're working great, and so he's not going to hire anymore. Well, now he fails the FTE portion of this bill. So this small business employer receives no benefit as he continues to grow his business and employ. This bill reduces the number of companies that will be able to use it. It's already complex. Adding these additional provisions only adds complexity. And as you've seen this morning, there is tremendous ambiguity. Members of my profession, as we prepare returns, are held to a standard. It's been mentioned that this would be a boon for my profession. I will tell you it's not. Because members of the public, taxpayers, don't understand what goes into their tax returns. They don't. They don't understand the complexity. And when my bill goes up, several hundred dollars perhaps, as we go through the calculations of payroll and assist them with that, their response to me is, well, Jason, it's the same business as it was last year. Why did my bill go up? It is not a boon for my industry either. It is additional complexity. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you for that. But you're not testifying to just leave things the way they are you?
I can speak to that, Chair, if you'd like me to. I believe, and I have some wealthy doctor or doctor equivalents who would be unhappy with me saying this, I believe that we should do something different. If what you're trying to do is increase jobs, this doesn't do it for many of the reasons that you've talked about. The other problem is the gotcha. I believe that there are practitioners like myself, gratefully I'm not one of them, at least not that I know of, who had conversations with their tax clients where they didn't realize that this was out there. There is no option to amend. The taxpayer says, so how much money did I lose? And then asks the tax practitioner for a check, because there's no going back to claim this benefit. That's Senate Bill 164. Mm-hmm. So if this provision stayed, Senate Bill 164 makes a great deal of sense. I'm not sure that this does what you want it to do if you're focusing on small business. It does go all the way up to those who are making millions of dollars, as well as small business. But yet it carves out a number of small businesses by its very provisions. I have a small business, just signed the return last week, about $1 million, maybe $2 million in revenue, great little employer, manufacturer, doesn't qualify. It's a C corporation. My wife runs a small business, has for years, wouldn't qualify because she doesn't have an employee, but go with the example for a moment, doesn't qualify because she's a sole proprietor. A sole proprietor running the exact same business as an S-corp or a partnership, where the S-corp or partnership does qualify, would not qualify. And we have lots of sole proprietorships in this state as well. I suggest that there is a better way. What that better way is, perhaps it's a lower rate for those businesses with lower income. If you're trying to incentivize them, we've heard testimony this morning about the fact that businesses don't always make money. Is there an incentive we can give business to build that employee base that allows them the growth? What that incentive is, I don't know. I didn't come prepared for that. I don't know. But I would be more than happy to think about it and talk with you as members of the committee, as would the OSCPA.
Well, we appreciate that very much. Questions, Mr. Orr, Senator Riley?
No, you asked the question I was going to ask.
So. Yeah. Senator Boquist?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I have about four.
Yes.
First, let me regroup and go backwards. So, because the good gentleman raises some very good points. And so, therefore, before we get to solutions, we need to understand how we got here. And members of your association actually did testify and come about this previously. And
yes, so they did.
Some of the challenges, that the issues you raise actually exist. And so now I need to walk down either why they didn't happen or so on and so forth, and then get your input from there. The whole concept of the bill really started down the road is that small businesses could not get credit because the banks don't like them. Your mm-hmm. CPA, the banks still don't like them. Mm-hmm. And so how do you create equity for expansion, and how do you regulate expansion? And expansion is really jobs, reinvestment, new investment. You heard that testimony. So that's sort of how we started down this road of this whole bill and this whole concept. And then it started getting really convoluted because, for example, as you pointed, figuring out what jobs are, we have tried this on the Betsy, and the majority of the individuals present trying to work this out, which are in the majority today, just so we're correct here, actually even agreed with the minority and said Business Oregon hasn't done a good job of figuring out what these jobs are and solar projects, so jobs is not something we can figure out how to at this point. The question of using some of the other IRS filings like 940s and 941 sorts of stuff would give us that, but we don't have access to it. Mm-hmm. We're out here talking about presidential tax returns, and not a member of us here can look at any tax return to even figure out what corporation's ripping us off and what's not.
Right.
I'm gonna come back to that point. So that's how we started down that one. Then the issue came up as well, if we do this, and the goal, once again, here's the goal, and I asked several of your predecessors, even in the last year, this question, is we're trying to establish equity so that they can expand, either in mm-hmm. job expansion, reinvestment, new investment. I don't need to tell you. You know the answers. There's ways to track that. If we had it, Section 179 would tell us if they're doing all kinds of things to tell us. We, just so you know, you get to see the return, not one of us, and not good Chris here, gets to see the return, so
right.
we're shooting blind.
Yes.
You know more than we know.
Yes.
Then the next question that came up is, as well, as you know, if this year I didn't take it, and next year if I'd have taken it, I had a tax advantage, people can game the system. So people, once again in the majority, said, we don't want them gaming the system, so we don't want it amended. And we said, fine, look, we won't amend it. That's how we got to the deal
yep.
where you can't amend it because nobody wanted to game the system. It is correct. 3 years back, right?
Correct.
Okay. Then the next thing came up, and you mentioned doctors and lawyers. Somebody said, well, we don't want the rich doctors and lawyers, but we really want active income.
And but the law says we can't discriminate against and get access to lawyers. So the LLPs, which you represent three, and the good gentleman in the back represents them, they couldn't be thrown out of the matrix. So that's why they stayed in. Mm-hmm. Again, both sides had to agree to that because the lawyer said you can't discriminate against these people. The sole proprietorship, I'll be blunt with you. Those of us supporting this wanted to do sole proprietorships, but then once again, those that are in charge said, no, it'll cost us too much money. Right? And then the next thing is everybody said they're all evil C corporations, and so we're not going to do C corporations. All this said, this is all, I was in the room, and mm-hmm. I testified to this, and everybody here. So back at square one, when you come back, and you comment today, but when you come back, once again, my question is back, and the reason we started this is we're trying to create the equity, right, the cash available in order to get financing to expand. And you know expansion is create jobs, reinvestment, and new investments. Mm-hmm. Now, one last caveat. Contrary to my good friends in the Taxpayers Association, I'm 180 degrees opposite of them in one instance. My district has seen no economic recovery. NFIB knows this. My members in my district, small business members, they have seen no economic recovery. His statistics prove this out. Small Business Association, TJ's members in my district, they've seen no economic recovery. So maybe Portlandia-centric organizations have seen economic recovery, but in my district, we don't. My small businesses in the NFIB, Small Business Association, even the Taxpayer Association, still can't get loans, still can't expand, and are still struggling. So the question is, whatever is better than this or however you improve it, and this is how we got to where we are, is, you know, really the answer. And it's not easy because we've tried this with C corporations in the Betsy. So I know you don't have an answer, but obviously the chair will give you time to some thoughts, but I'm all ears.
Would you like to respond to his version of history?
I could get your majority leader down here, and she would have tested this out.
Part.
Okay.
What you describe is a challenge, and in fact, the provision as it stands now, ignoring 165 tacking onto it, doesn't address the challenges. And you're right. Years ago, I said, and I've watched tax law become more and more complex over my career. Years ago, I said that the folks who passed tax law back in D.C. need to be locked in a room and do their own returns by hand using the instructions provided to normal taxpayers without the aid of computers and would have much different law. I know that you don't see what we do, and so it's hard to promulgate something, and then we see it on the ground and go, well, wait a minute, and I understand that. The people in your constituency, the original law may not be helping much because I have clients that are growing businesses. They're struggling. I mean, break even is awesome. Break even is wonderful. They receive no benefit from this at all because this is a reduction of tax rate on income. Not wages coming, not my wages as an S-Corp owner, but my income as an S-Corp owner coming out of the corporation doesn't help any of your folks. It doesn't. So what does?
You can come back, and you're wrong. It doesn't.
You know what? I would love to be able to think about that and come back. I would love to be able to talk to some of our constituency and come back. Yeah. I truly would. Because one of the things that's challenging for the taxpayers is they want these things, you know, that we want to help businesses grow. We want to help these guys get back on their feet, these guys and gals. But the complexity kills them. Because we have people who don't want to pay someone like me to do their own returns. Sometimes that's wonderful. And in a self-compliant system, frankly, that's how it ought to be. But the complexity is such that many people can't do their own returns competently. We need something simple. I don't have an answer for what that simple is.
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Just so I do have constituents who did take advantage of this, and they were helped. And I do know constituents in the state of Oregon across the board that took advantage of this and actually did more than $10 million in expansion.
Right.
So there are some.
There are some.
I get all the pieces. You're out there. The question is, what is the solution? Not let's argue about it.
Agreed. I would like to find a solution. I don't know what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Orme, you've been most helpful.
Appreciate Thank you.
It. And I look forward to engaging more with you on this. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I want to get through this. We still have another hearing after this. So Chris Allman and Jody Weiser.
Yeah.
Can I use the restroom? I'll be right back.
Chair Haas and members of the Senate Finance Committee, and my name is Chris Allman, and first of all, I am a lay resident from Washington County, and Senator Haas knows me well because I've been coming down to Salem since 2003, and a lot of what I've been concerned about is how do we have adequate revenue for all the very important services, and in that case it was education that I was following, that we need. The preaching that came from the choirs was it has to be fair. And so I can tell you that the Portland Metro is all they're looking at you to create a fair structure of taxation. And it's important that you're going to be raising revenue to fill this $1.8 billion shortfall. So while we have corporations, big corporations that are clearly not paying their fair share, I don't understand why this special tax break was put together in 2013. So for the record, I will say that I think this whole provision needs to be repealed. And it is going to be necessary as you think about how you raise revenue to potentially just say, okay, let's put this all in one big package and say we made a big mistake. Because when it comes to tax expenditures, they're so easy to give away. There's no acknowledgement of how you have to raise special revenue for it. So when you do that, and then you put that burden on future legislatures to figure out how to fill the holes, that's wrong. So we've heard all this testimony about the complexity. I can speak to physicians. Physicians are increasingly salaried because yes, the complexity is out there. But don't blame it on the tax structure. Blame it on the mess of what we've created with health care. We need single-payer financing, frankly. But that ain't going to happen for a while. So do not feel sorry for these wealthier physicians who are churning more money from this tax break. I agree with Senator Boquist. Yes, those small businesses in rural areas that aren't benefiting because they can't pay to get this tax break, what are we really benefiting from? So I look at this and I say, well, what an error to have created this. I mean, I would not have known about this aside from the fact that I've read in Willamette Week that it's a $120 million boondoggle, which is obviously going to go up since more people are going to be aware of it. And I, you know, I've raised some suggestions, but I know they're stupid because they will make it more complex and because they probably can't be fully regulated. So I'm saying repeal it. That's what I'm saying. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody.
Senator Haas and members of the committee, we oppose the bill as written. We oppose the concept when it happened in 2013. There's the way do you get businesses to grow is by delivering them customers. They grow, they hire more people because they have more customers to serve, and the legislature can't really do that. You don't have the capacity to grow them customers. We know from the testimony you've heard in this room that it's brought as much as a $60,000 tax benefit to a single business owner, and a business owner that is making $5 million a year doesn't need help in getting access to capital. I think there's two things that have been talked about in terms of this bill, job creation and access to capital. And you passed Senate Bill 1589, which allows access to $30 million worth of capital for businesses that actually need it and apply, and we guarantee loans. That's a much more direct way to get the get money to the people who need it, and way less expensive than what we're doing now, where the business owner might easily just put that extra $20,000 or $5,000 into an IRA account or some other investment that has nothing to do with their business. It's just an inefficient way to go about what you're doing. If you're worried about not being able to get the votes together to end it, then I think you need to find some much stronger provisions to make it not easily played. This is a court case waiting to be taken, because we don't have a good definition of what an increase in FTE means in the bill. And there's nothing in the law that requires these jobs not be jobs that we're going to subsidize, because the people are so poorly paid that they are using, the public assistance. That's not exactly the kind of jobs that we need to be encouraging, but we don't have any provisions that require high-quality jobs in the law. So I've suggested on page 2 of my testimony some things that could be added that would make it actually be more beneficial, but I'm not sure that it makes sense to be adding provisions rather than just ending it as an idea that didn't work. It was part, the PERS changes that it was tied to also didn't work. And so you could say, okay, we didn't get the PERS money, we need to give up this tax break for businesses. My CPA called me during the February session and said, what is this new law? Why did you let this happen? And later he told me that his client who earned the most from it saved $20,000 on his taxes, and he said he was already buying up other businesses and laying people off. That's not a provision that was working in that particular case to create jobs, because we gave him more capital to buy up more businesses and lay people off. So I think the best solution is to take this what I heard was 100, well, what I read, and I had to ask Chris how I happened to hear this number, but the governor's budget said that if we end this thing, it'll save us $177 million, and we have way better places to spend that money, but we know what we're getting. You could retain 1,040 teachers for 2 years with that kind of money. That's a lot of teachers. You could prop up PERS with $177 million. You could keep an adequate number of foster care workers protecting our most vulnerable children. You could continue Oregon Promise and add money to our Oregon Opportunity Grant program so that it's easier for kids to go to college. $177 million has a lot of places where you know how it could be spent. And in this case, you haven't. We've got some statistics today, but you don't know how that money is being deployed and what it's doing for the state. And the kinds of things I just named are where your responsibility lies. So I urge you to end the provision entirely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. the Department of Revenue is here. Deanna, did you need to weigh in on this?
So it's about 66 right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I'll make it quick because the society actually carried most of the concerns that we have. It's very complex. Need some clear definitions, and they've got them well outlined in there. The only other thing that I wanted to add, and some people alluded to it, it would be an audit issue. It would not be something that we would have really up front, and it would be complex. The entity, there's nothing that requires the entity, because the bill requires the entity to do this work, but there's nothing that requires the entity to give that information to the shareholders when it passes its income through on the K-1. So there's an entity level action that needs to be done, and then the income comes through to the shareholder or the partner. They may or may not necessarily have that information, which is fairly complex. So we would if you do proceed with this bill, ask that there's some sort of communication between the two so that the individual taxpayer has the information they can prove to qualify for this And that's it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 165. And for the time we have left, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 468. Kyle is here for a quick summary.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 468 is a bill that would make some changes to a property tax exemption that was relatively newly created back in the 2016 session, Senate Bill 1565. So I thought I'd briefly describe the exemption that was created in the 2016 session and then go over the changes in 468. But just as a reminder, Senate Bill 1565 in 2016, it created a permissive property tax exemption or a deferral. So it was allowing cities or counties through an ordinance or resolution to provide a property tax exemption for newly constructed or installed industrial improvements. And the requirement in the statute had it being the initial cost of investment of those improvements would have to be at minimum $1 million, although with the permissive language, through the ordinance or the resolution, the city or the county could set those limits at a different amount. So they could start it at $1 million. You couldn't go less than that, but you could set it at $5 million, $10 million, or something to that effect. So that's some of the permissiveness of it. It provided the exemption for up to 5 years. The standard language was any three consecutive years of five, but again, the city or the county can adjust that. And there was a requirement that the combined rate of the tax imposed on the property, the districts, that get that combined rate up to 75% would have to more or less okay the exemption before it could be provided. So it did give some weighing in for other local districts outside of the city or the county. And then the last part was the location requirements, which was the requirement was that the industrial improvements would have to be located in an area outside an urban growth boundary of a city of 40,000 or more. And that would include combined UGB, so the metro UGB, which grab the Portland metro region and the cities within, would be there as well. Senate Bill 468, what it does, it makes a number of clarification changes and some closer to, I guess, policy changes as well. So it defines the eligible location to include a location that has not been formally used for industrial purposes. It does make some clarification relating to the definition of eligible property to include industrial property, whether it's assessed by the local assessor or the Department of Revenue. It does expand the definition of eligible property and include property that's constructed or installed at a brownfield and allows for that initial cost of investment, so that $1 million or something that the city or county could set higher, the cleanup cost of the brownfield could be included in that. So it wouldn't be just the industrial property for meeting that minimum threshold. There are changes to the definition of the rural area. So it would include area outside of unincorporated territories or outside of city boundaries, and then also clarifies that for the UGB discussion, it's a city with a population less than 40,000, so be located entirely outside of the urban growth boundaries of any and all cities. So that's to re-emphasize that it would be a UGB that covers maybe multiple cities. So you could think Salem, Kaiser, but definitely the metro one is probably the better example, where there are a number of cities within the Portland metro UGB that are less than 40,000.
Thank you. Commissioner Cameron has been patiently waiting throughout the morning. Can he come up with Bill Cross?
I want to sit. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of Willamette Valley Vineyards, and I think Mr. Eason has done a great job on summarizing Senate Bill 1565, which we appreciated your support and passage last session, and then trying to identify the changes that would be addressed in Senate Bill 468. And these were identified basically through some conversations and meetings that I had with Marion County Marion County had expressed some interest in trying to pursue developing a program. And as we were kind of walking through the legislation and trying to identify possible, you know, properties and eligibility, some of the definitions, we determined that there were some maybe need for further clarification so that the county would have, or any jurisdiction would have, the proper direction as they move forward. And I'll let Commissioner Cameron kind of articulate some of those concerns that evolved during those discussions.
Thank you. Chair Haas, good to see you. Members of the committee, it's always good to be back in the building and then leave very quickly. So thank you for allowing me to testify today. Yes, Marion County, obviously Willamette Valley Vineyards is in Marion County, and this bill was brought last session by Willamette Valley Vineyards, and we wanted to take a look at this. One of the things I want to step back, one of the things we've been doing in Marion County is we have a lot of rural areas that have been hurting, and specifically the North Santa Ana River Canyon that is still trying to recover from the late 1980s and find a new economic base of tourism and some other things that are up there. And there's a lot of industrial properties that were old mill sites. This bill, this concept, is really something that we're excited about because you can really drill down on a specific property if there's somebody who wants to develop it, redevelop it, and invest in it. So we were we formed a group of people, including our legal counsel, our economic development people, myself, our assessor who is here today. We started to go through the bill and say, how could we get this implemented? What are the challenges that we have? So before you, you have some of the fixes that we think would really help us define the challenges that we had in implementing this bill in Marion County. One of the things that I really appreciate about this is that I think you may hear some criticism that we would, you know, make the whole county an enterprise zone. If you look at this bill, you have to get taxing district support to actually implement this bill in a specific area. So it would not be countywide. It would be only in a specific area where you were trying to achieve this and help somebody make investments. It would be 3 out of 5 years of property tax, either deferral or abatement. We have those options. I really appreciate the flexibility that the legislature has given us as county commissioners versus just some of the bills that come out of here for property tax reductions that we have no options. We just have to implement them. So this is a bill that is permissive. Not all counties will take advantage of it, but we see an opportunity in Marion County with some of these fixes to be able to be the first county to implement this and see some economic development as a result of this great piece of legislation you passed last session with some fine-tuning.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think you watching that previous bill here, you caught a glimpse of some of the fun times that you left behind.
Yes.
Questions?
I was not here for that grand bargain, but I think that's what you're talking about. Hey, I was here for the grand bargain.
Senator Boquist?
Oh, I just want to comment that there are some people, Commissioner, on this dais to my right who aren't thinking it was so grand, and unfortunately, there's some people being punished because of failures of the grand bargain, too. So,
this
you're good
you
not to be
behind.
Here.
Yeah,
you don't want to touch that one.
Okay.
Questions?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Garst. Mark Garst, yeah, there he is.
Morning. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. As I let Senator Boquist know yesterday, the department has a couple of concerns about some of the language that we have here in the bill. We're happy to work with you to kind of get those sorted out. One thing that I would just like to get on the record is that this bill makes some tweaks to Senate Bill 1565, and that includes some changes to what is included in eligible property, and so it allows that property to be installed on a brownfield. But we still think that generally, we think that the courts are going to read statutes to give effect to all provisions. And so we think that the requirements that were in the original bill, that the property has to be newly installed, we think that that still holds, even with this new brownfield language. And so the way that we see the brownfield language really working is that costs may have been spent in the past that made the brownfield cleanup. That can be used to determine whether or not you fall within the $1 million to $25 million criteria for qualifying for the exemption. But as far as what property is going to be exempted, it's only going to be newly constructed and installed property based off of our read on this. So if the intent's different, we can definitely work with you on language and get that squared away. And then I just want to point out that the definition changes to rural area. I know this definition is really hard for people to read. It gets a lot of bad words said about it, but the original definition in the bill would not have included a lot of unincorporated areas of counties that are located within urban growth boundaries that are have any city with a population of greater than 40,000, and this would change that. So, for instance, within the Kaiser Salem urban growth boundary, if you were outside of city limits, you would still be considered rural area. And that's how we read it, and I think that's probably the intent, and that's fine. So, again, we're neutral on the policy. I just wanted to bring those to you.
Appreciate that. Questions? Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
And Jody Weiser, I have you signed up, but we're right at the end of the day here. Are you? We have your testimony in the record.
You have it.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. We have our work cut out for us on both of these bills. And hope you can give some thinking to it, along with the CPAs who are helping us as well. So silence hits.
It's golden today.
Silence, yeah. We are adjourned.
Or it's golden today.
Silence, yeah. We are